The following podcast is sponsored by Financial Sense Wealth Management. To learn more about our investment services, go to financialsense.com or give us a call at 888-486-3939.
What we're going through right now is California's worst fire season on record. The largest, the third largest, and the fourth largest fire in state history are burning at the same time.
The fires that are going on in the western United States right now are unprecedented, even to our most senior leadership.
Overnight, a state of emergency declared in California as a trio of fires rages across the state.
It feels like the end of the world. It's pretty scary.
As apocalyptic scenes play out across the West, tonight inside the burn zone, destruction and loss are mounting. A devastating and historic fire season with four more months left until its official end.
This is the Financial Sense News Hour. Now, here's the Financial Sense News Team.
The major indexes continue their sell-off this week as worries over the economy and the future outcome of this fall's election weigh on the markets. Most of the major indexes are down close to 2% for the week, with tech stocks leading the downturn. Hi everyone, I'm Jim Poplava, and welcome to this week's Financial Sense News Hour. Joining me this week will be Dave Nikoski from Vermilion Research. Dave sees the technology sector pulling back 8 to 10%, some of these high flyers probably even more, while he is also seeing trouble brewing in the financial sector and in real estate. I'll have more to say about that in the big picture this week as we try to make sense out of what is nonsense in economic policies and how this is all interrelated. Greg Orrell, portfolio manager of the OCM Gold Fund, also joins me as we discuss the wave of institutional money moving into the precious metals sector, the risk of paper gold contracts in the futures market, and why, if you are in metals, you want to own the physical. But first, let's find out what moved this week's market with Ryan Poplava. Ryan?
Thanks, Jim. We came back to the market after a holiday Monday, but sellers got right to work first thing on Tuesday, carrying that momentum from last week's sell-off driven in high-priced technology, growth, and mega-cap names. The FANG index fell between 4.5% to 7.5% on the week following last week's similar sell-off. Tesla, another growth and momentum name, fell another 11% when the S&P 500 Index Committee dismissed their entry into the well-known index. Some of the key negative headlines this week were the failure of the Senate to pass a revised coronavirus relief bill to the tune of $300 billion, and many senators voiced pessimism any bill would get through before elections now. It seems the biggest issue between the parties is regarding the amount, number one, and policy differences like unemployment insurance and more money for state and local governments. This is where they just can't agree. Another negative headline that hurt stocks was the news that AstraZeneca paused its COVID-19 vaccine research due to a serious adverse reaction in a patient. I'm not sure what that was. Obviously serious enough to pause. But Boeing announced that production problems have slowed the pace of deliveries for its 787 Dreamliner. Saudi Aramco lowered its prices for oil for buyers in Asia and in the U.S., due to sluggish demand, and that had an immediate effect on West Texas Intermediate crude, with prices dropping 6% this week, following almost a 7.5% drop last week. Finally, President Trump had suggested this week possibly disincentivizing U.S. companies outsourcing jobs to China, and China's largest semiconductor foundry could be added to a trade blacklist, which then resulted in fears of possible retaliation on our own semiconductor companies, further weakening the already weak tech sector's performance. The S&P finished down 7% from its record highs, and the NASDAQ finished down this week 10% below its record highs as of the close on Friday. There was an attempt to rally on Wednesday that was spearheaded by the mega caps and tech sector, but that fizzled out on Wednesday as that news came with the Senate not being able to pass the relief bill. Despite that news, it continues to be felt by many that this largely remains a technical event, But the negative headlines this week were enough to discourage more than a single day's rally. Some key earnings highlights this week were Slack, stock tickers Work, W-O-R-K, Lululemon, Athletica, L-U-L-U, and luxury home goods retailer RH, just RH. While all three had impressive results, only RH was able to rally on their report. Slack fell 14% as investors were disappointed with their 49% jump in revenues, focusing instead on their weaker than expected billings, which is sort of a measure of future growth. But at 16 times earnings right now, 16 times the upper end of its 2021 revenue guidance, some do feel that the valuation is fair right here. Lululemon had impressive online sales, which are now larger than its store sales at 61% of revenues. The issue wasn't with its current performance, but rather the conservative guidance they gave, expecting revenues to fall by 15 to 20% in the third quarter, citing COVID still creating uncertainties. One issue on the storefront for them has been their small store size. In the past, small stores, high traffic drove productivity. But due to safety and only allowing a few guests in at a time, their small store size is actually working against Lululemon. But again, online sales are really killing it there. Finally, looking at RH, the luxury home goods retailer, product margins jumped by almost 50% based on the company's goals and objective to improve product design and quality. Its choice to invest in these areas like product quality, galleries, and its new offerings versus focusing on online shopping really are a stark contrast to the likes of Target, Home Depot, and Walmart. The company currently has an operating margin of 14.3% in 2019 and believes that they can get that to 20% in 2020. I love one of the most recent notes by their CEO, Gary Friedman, who said in their second quarter letter, "I cannot name one retail brand that shrunk to greatness. Closing stores is always the answer in the quest to survive, but it has never been a strategy to thrive." Well said. Looking at revenues, the problem hasn't been demand, but rather supply in the current COVID economy. But it's also good to see that demand trends are improving for stores, up 23% in June, 26% in July, 38% in August, and 37% so far in September. So way to go there, sir. That's it for this week's report. Back to you, Jim, with our guest technician this week.
David Trainer, founder and CEO of New Constructs, joins us today. If you've been watching the financial channels over the past few weeks, you've probably seen David in the news. He's been debating the Tesla bulls, explaining why Tesla is such a dangerous stock to own. And David, the first question I want to ask you is the recent price action that we've seen, 30% decline in just 5 days from the September 1st peak, that's pretty big. Is that exactly the sort of danger that you were warning about in that piece from August?
Absolutely. I think it's the tip of the iceberg for what can happen to this stock. We're focused on reverse engineering or quantifying the future cash flows and all the attendant operational performance achievements needed to justify the stock price. So a big part of what we're doing with Tesla is just saying, look, you know, in order to justify the stock, and when we wrote this report back in August, you know, we were looking at price of around, I think in today's post-split, of $500. And the performance implications of that, when you just look at the dollars and revenues, you know, they're crazy, right? And but we've been doing this for a long time, and that was not enough context. So what we decided to do is say, all right, looking at different average selling prices for Tesla cars, how many cars would they have to generate to meet these revenue and cash flow expectations? And then what levels of market share does that translate to with respect to electronic vehicles? And what we found was really rather astonishing. So if we're talking about an average selling price of $37,000, which is the average car price in the United States in 2019, Tesla would have to produce by 2030, 16.7 million vehicles, or 64% of the electric vehicle market. If we're talking about an average selling price of $24,000, which is equal to where Toyota is, that's about 26 million vehicles, or 100% of the EV market expected in 2030. And then if we're talking about a $16,000 average selling price, which is where General Motors average selling price is, we're talking about 38.8 million vehicles, or 150%. And so the 30% decline you know, is a fair haircut to those numbers, because obviously we're not at $500 anymore, but we're still talking about 40%+ as a minimum of sort of the expectation for where Tesla is going to be in terms of market share.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Financial Sense Wealth Management has put together a portfolio of high dividend paying blue chips, high quality interest paying bonds, and preferred stocks. Our income account portfolio is specifically designed to help meet the needs of retirees, pension funds, and foundations looking to increase income and reduce taxes. To learn more, contact us at 888-486-3939 or email grow@financialsense.com.
Markets are going back and forth, but one thing that we've seen is the laws of gravity going into effect. Just when you thought techs could just keep going higher, well, they're pulling back. Joining us on the program from Vermilion Research is Dave Nikoski. Dave, let's begin with tech, which has been one of the main drivers of the markets this year, all the way, including its influence on the S&P 500. It looks like it's pulling back. Is this a correction, or could this be something more serious, given the valuations of many of these companies?
Yeah, it's too early to tell if this is just a correction. My concern would be that, you know, we're seeing some, the pullback obviously is something that we warned about a couple weeks ago. We suggested that we could see an 8% to 12% pullback, and this certainly fits into, you know, what we thought. Many stocks were getting extended from the 200-day at levels, you know, that mimic what we saw back in, you know, March of 2000. It's too early to, you know, suggest that it's a bearish flag that we're forming on these particular individual stocks, as well as the sector overall. One thing that troubles me is, you know, despite the ongoing concern about COVID, is, you know, you do have somewhat of a breakdown or a rounding top forming in the XBI, which is the biotech names. And you've been doing that for, you know, close to a month now. So without any ability to muster out any gains or break the downtrend. So right now we're, it looks like we're rallying back to the downtrend that's still intact.
So usually if you think there's going to be something more serious, or maybe there's problems in the economy, you would see the defensives. I want to talk about two sectors, consumer discretionary and consumer staples. Normally, discretionary, if things are going well, people are spending money, and then consumer staples, if people and portfolio managers are concerned about maybe economic weakness, but they're both doing well.
What I'm seeing in the consumer discretionary, and you're seeing it, you know, in the teenage retailer stocks, as well as the, you know, the big box retailers are starting to form bottoms. And, you know, maybe the investor or the outlook is that, you know, we move back to a reopening, and especially coming around election time. I think that's what we're starting to see in terms of the chart patterns out there. You're seeing it in the airlines, you're seeing it in the cruise, you know, the cruise line stocks, you're seeing it, the casino related names are also doing quite well. Staples that, you know, obviously a defensive posturing, but on a relative strength basis, you know, they haven't been doing all that great. So, you know, it's something that we're watching closely to see if, you know, we are going to get a trade back into defensive names. Looks like the staples have bottomed, but again, they're not significantly outperforming when we look, you know, over the last 4 or 5 months.
Let's talk about some areas that are having some trouble. And this relates also to, let's say, if there's going to be a defensive trend. Let's talk about utilities and REITs, which have gone nowhere.
Well, I think the REITs have their own issues, you know, associated with COVID, and that's, you're seeing a lot of businesses close down and having been, you know, having been shut for a number of months, and we don't know what the fallout is in terms of bankruptcies. Utilities have, you know, we're underweight utilities that continue to be mired in a downtrend all the way from the March lows in the market. You know, price pattern wise, it's it's, you know, moving sideways and has been unable to take out, you know, the June highs. Again, that's still an area that we have as an underweight. I don't see any reason to be there unless we prop up and move above the 200 day. I don't see a defensive posturing across the board at this point in time.
And let's talk about two areas that look troublesome. Just when you think things can't get worse for energy, they appear to be doing just that. Oil's below $40 a barrel. You got the XLE, just seems like it's there's no bottom to it. And then also some emerging problems in the financial area. Let's talk about those two sectors.
Yeah, we went to an underweight on energy last week, and you know, I continue to see that you know, where the XLE is breaking down, the RYE is breaking down and breaking below the June lows. Those aren't something that I like to see. You know, I would like to see some confirmation out of energy. However, I think that, you know, with the aspect of what we've seen with COVID, I think that you're seeing a lot of firms move to, you know, working from home or hybrid type model like we're seeing within the school system across the country. And I think that, you know, brings about less driving, less, consuming of energy. You're seeing the airlines, again, you're not seeing at least rate of travel climbing. And again, I think that's troublesome for energy. You know, over the next year is again, I think the model at which we had been at prior to COVID is certainly something that we're seeing, you know, firms shift to that home type business. And we're not seeing the uptick in air travel to a degree that would consume energy. So I think energy is one of the wild cards that, you know, we probably won't get a confirmation that the market has bottomed. My other area of concern, however, is I think even bigger, and that's, you know, the aspect that we're seeing the financials break down, or the banking system, in terms of the KRE, which is the regional banks. I think that, you know, when we look back at history, you know, when you get something like the regional banks breaking down, or the banks overall, you know, that's very troublesome, and it could, you know, be an indication of systemic risk that we don't have a sound banking system at this point in time. And, you know, I'm sure Congress or the president will rush in at some point if these continue to move to, you know, relative strength lows.
Yeah, because, you know, you mentioned the REITs. They're having trouble. Shopping centers, stores are not allowed to be open. They're shutting down. A lot of businesses are going under. Well, what's the other side of that coin? These businesses occupy retail space. Who owns that space? The REITs. Who's made the loans on a lot of that space? The banks. So it seems like they're all interrelated.
Yeah, kind of a chain of events that, you know, could cause some unwinding here. And that's probably my greatest concern when you know, most banks can't foreclose, you can't have evictions until, you know, after the first of the year. And it seems to be, at least at my latest tally, has been about 8.2% of mortgages are in forbearance. That's a pretty high number. I believe during the financial crisis of 2008-09, it was around 14.2%. So certainly not as great. But I think it's still troublesome that, you know, we could see a flood of homes go on the market after the first of the year. And that could certainly, you know, upset the market.
So when you're looking at this market, and it's been full steam ahead since the bottom of the market in March, when you're looking, when markets go up parabolic, as we saw with tech, as we saw with the S&P, with the tech influence, you see them pull back. If you were looking for trouble to erupt, you just alluded to one area, which is financials. We could have some problems there. Anything else that you would be looking at to tell you, boy, I better pay a closer attention and watch this for, let's say, maybe something more serious in the market?
Well, I think looking at the FANG stocks, we you know, again, they're quite extended, and, you know, they're coming back to their trend lines, but they're still far above the 200-day. When I see names out there like Zoom, which, you know, a great product, great avenue to, you know, connect with you know, it reminds me of going back in time where, you know, back in 99, 2000 and 2001, where, you know, Polycom was the medium at which firms, you know, when you went to the cocooning effect after 2001, everyone, you know, every office conference room you walked into had a Polycom device, and it was sold years later over to Cisco. You know, my concern is that the barriers to entry are probably not as great as what the market expects or from a long-term basis. Again, I think that the stock is just too extended for me to go out there and recommend it. It may be leadership, but it's very hard to get new clients to invest in it at the levels that we're seeing and the price gains you've seen. Looking at biotech, which is kind of a speculative area, and if that's, you know, rounding over, you know, if it can happen to biotech, it can happen to tech. And that's my greatest concern. When you look back at March of 2000, you know, one of the reasons that, you know, the market got pricked at that time is Tony Blair and Bill Clinton were sitting at a podium in London, and Human Genome Sciences had just decoded the human genome. And, you know, they sat up on a podium and suggested that Human Genome Sciences should share that information with every healthcare company. And that's really the day of the pricking of the bubble. That was the very top.
So when you look at this, let's talk about another sector that's doing well. I wonder if you'd spend some time talking about what's going on with the precious metals and the gold stocks.
Yeah, we are bullish on gold long term. It would seem that, you know, I think the entire world is mired in debt, and you have some absolutely monster basis happening in the gold and silver, platinum, palladium markets, and it would suggest that it's going to move much higher from here.
So given the fact that we see some danger signs out there, you know, mortgage defaults or in forbearance, that figure is high. We're seeing a little bit of trouble erupt in the financials. Let's talk about some other areas of the market, which we talked about the defensives, and they're not doing as well. So if you were to suspect that maybe we're heading into a little bit more serious trouble, would you suspect maybe areas like utilities, consumer staples, other areas to sort doing well along with, let's say, gold stocks?
Yeah, I would say, you know, it's I like what I see in the retail sector and the consumer discretionary. Home builders is another avenue that, you know, seems to be doing quite well along with anything associated with the, you know, the building of new homes. I would say that, you know, even manufacturing has some, you know, pretty bright spots, and most of those areas are associated with the home building. I continue to like them, but that's another area that I would also watch. If we see something rolling over, it might be more indicative of a, you know, an economic slowdown despite the low interest rate environment we have.
You know, the one thing that we saw in the 90s, the booming market, we saw technology, the internet, computers became ubiquitous along with cell phones. Let's talk about some other things that we've seen as a result of COVID. We've seen companies like Zoom, video conferencing. Companies are saying, you know what, maybe we don't have to put our people on a plane, send them to a conference and spend the money. We can just have a Zoom conference. Let's talk also about the emergence of 5G and how that may be reshaping our economy.
I do think that most firms are gravitating towards, you know, the cocooning effect and reducing their amount of travel using, you know, mediums such as Zoom or other devices. Slack is another one that you know, I think a lot of clients are turning towards in terms of communicating with their client base. Instead of, again, going out and doing travel, you know, it's interesting that, you know, we see the hotels are reflecting potential bottoms from your Marriott's, your Hilton's, to your Wynn's. I think that we are changing the face of how business is done and how spending is done. And I think you're seeing a great amount of curtailing of business travel due to the COVID.
It relates to what we're seeing in commercial real estate and a lot of companies, even with the idea that people are teleworking, where a lot of businesses have said, you know what, we don't need as much commercial office space. So, you know, what I'm trying to think going forward in terms of investing, what stocks or what industries are going to start to do well as a result of this change? Because I think, Dave, even if we come up with a vaccine or a cure, I think people's habits, I mean, if they come up with a vaccine, are you going to want to go in a movie theater and sit next to a guy that's coughing right away or go to a gym? I think a lot of that, you know, you look at companies like Peloton, there was questions whether their business model would work. But with COVID, I mean, their stock is up, what, 80, 90% as more people start buying home equipment saying, you know what, maybe I don't need to spend that money and go to the gym.
Yeah, this looks exactly like 9/11, where you had the cocooning effect. And, you know, you at that time, families spent more time together. And it was, you know, either going up north, going to a lake home, going to fish. And you're seeing that in Thor and Winnebago, such that, you know, families are spending more time with each other and going to campgrounds, doing fishing. You see it in the Polaris Industries, you know, instead of spending that money on a vacation, spend it, you know, spend it with time with the family without going to anywhere extravagant like Europe or Florida for the summer vacation. And I think that is changing the dynamics of, you know, how one lives their life and how one spends time with their family.
All right. Well, given this, Dave, what would you be doing as an investor at this point?
I would be looking at the retail stocks, the consumer discretionary stocks. I'm a little leery of jumping back into tech. My concern about tech is, you know, throughout time, we do know that it's cyclical. And you saw that in March of 2000. I don't see that it can continue at the rate that it's going up. I do love it. I do think that that's the way around COVID. However, I also think that, you know, many firms stepped up their capital spending due to migrating their employees to work from home. And I'm concerned more that that capital spending could start to see some, you know, a second derivative year over year growth is not going to be to the extent of which it was during COVID, especially if we move into a, you know, an open up, opening up the country over the next year. I just don't see how that's gonna sit with the overall market. My biggest concern, like I say, are the financials and the fallout from that, and I think that could be systemic risk that's starting to form.
All right. Well, Dave, as we close, why don't you tell our listeners how they can find out more about Vermilion? You guys really do a lot of in-depth market analysis, in particular, looking at different sectors, which ones are doing well and which ones to avoid.
And we also cover all the ETFs out there as well as an international product that we also cover by geographic region, sector, as well as industry. Our number is 952-922-7500. And we can are also on the internet, www.vermilioncap.com.
All right. Well, listen, Dave, as always, thanks for joining us on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
Thank you, Jim. I appreciate your time.
$29, $69, and $99, all these periods of radical commodity undervaluation ended the day that you had a major change in the global monetary system. I think we're seeing that again. You know, I think what we're seeing today is the end of the system that has basically been in place for the last 25 years. And the system by which you effectively have the US dollar as a sacrosanct reserve currency around the world. And I think you're starting to see signs of that coming apart. You know, Goldman Sachs a couple weeks ago put out a big report that said the US dollar reserve currency status is under threat. Gold is certainly telling you that there's problems in the fiat money world today. And so I think that that's been the big change since the last time we spoke. Not necessarily that commodities are now, you know, normal relative to financial assets in terms of price. They're not. They're still really, really cheap. But I think the catalyst is in place now.
If you want to listen to this full interview, just go to financialsense.com and click the subscribe button.
Call Financial Sense Wealth Management at 888-486-3939. Let's work together to create a better path to your financial future. Call 888-486-3939 today. Advisory services offered through Financial Sense Advisors, Inc., a registered investment advisor. Securities offered through Financial Sense Securities, Inc., member FINRA SIPC. Both companies doing business as Financial Sense Wealth Management.
Well, it's been a good year for gold investors. Even though the market seems to be consolidating, there are great expectations as to where gold is heading. Joining us on the program is Greg Orrell from the OCM Gold Fund. Greg, let's take a look at gold and begin with that. It was doing very well, and then all of a sudden we've got this sort of sideways motion in gold. What's your take from gold here, number one? And number two, what do you think are going to be the catalyst going forward?
Well, thanks, Jim. I think, first off, gold's had a pretty strong move from basically, if you go back to last July when it broke through 1380. I mean, even at that time when we said, you know, you get the, as technicians like to say, you get, you know, the price action first and the narrative would follow. I don't think we ever thought that it would be a pandemic that would be, you know, that catalyst. And then the follow on monetary response. And, you know, so right now I think, you know, we are taking a bit of a breather, whether that is, you know, some hope that maybe the economy is going to be a little bit stronger and we're backing off a little bit as you see some profit taking. But I think the momentum is there, you know, after you do a bit of a pullback to push through 2000, these round numbers always seem to be a bit of a barrier. And, you know, the first, you know, going back to when gold went through 1,000 the first time, it took a few times, and then when it finally blew through, it blew through convincingly. And I think that you'll see the same thing with $2,000 gold.
Well, if we look at the monetary backdrop, and let's talk about the dollar and then also future stimulus. There's an impasse right now. Republicans want $1 trillion stimulus. Democrats want $3 trillion plus. In one way or another, they're going to put another stimulus program, which is just going to further exacerbate the deficit, and the Fed's going to have to finance that. That has to be positive for gold.
Well, absolutely. I think if you look at, you know, the bookies probably have Trump as a, you know, Trump and Biden in a dead heat. And I would say that maybe Trump has a slight edge, but, you know, coming out of the conventions, but, you know, when you compare the two of them, both will have policies that will drive the deficits higher and total federal debt higher. And we always go back to, I like to always say, you know, since Nixon closed the gold window, what was the, you know, one of the highest correlations that gold has is to total federal debt outstanding at 91%. So if you believe that, you know, the deficit's going to continue to climb, and I see no reason why it won't under either administration. And under Trump, it's gone up, you know, from just a little under $20 trillion to $27 trillion. You know, that's a pretty significant percentage increase. That's going exponential. And, you know, the gold market is looking at that, you know, from a debasement, currency debasement standpoint. And, you know, when Powell came out of the virtual Jackson Hole Symposium a little over at the end of August, you know, shifting kind of the goalpost to average inflation rate, you know, signaling that, you know, they'll allow further further debasement of the dollar, and, you know, they'll push out the yield curve further and further as time goes on here. You know, I think that is you know, one of the catalysts that, you know, will continue to drive gold and investors towards gold assets in general.
Let's talk about contrast what the government is doing now compared to, let's say, coming out of the financial crisis. We did get an initial stimulus close to $1 trillion with Obama, but then that was it. Then they came in with the sequester. The Fed continued to print money, but the only inflation we really saw in the economy, Greg, was in the financial markets. How would you contrast 2008 in the response to what we're seeing now?
I would say that we were still in a period where deflation was being exported from overseas manufacturing centers, and that allowed the massive increase in money supply that was much greater than GDP growth. to where that inflation went into the financial markets. And I would say where we're going now, especially as Trump is looking to decouple the U.S. from China, you know, on an economic standpoint, that we are looking at a scenario where we'll see those inflationary pressures start to come back into the market as basically you're going to get a rebalance of the water tables here. This is something I think that's the market from a, you know, fearing deflation now I think is going to start to fear inflation going forward.
So you can see that switch. Let's talk about some of the other elements in the precious metals market. Let's talk about silver and also the fact that this time around the stocks seem to be confirming the precious metals.
Yeah, there's certainly, you know, confidence has come back into slowly. It's still not completely there. It's starting to come back into the sector where, you know, management, you know, they've done a good job of repairing investor sentiment towards the sector. You know, I've always liked to say, you know, the last time around, you know, people buy gold assets as a protection for debasement on currency. And especially gold shares, you know, there's the leverage and silver shares for the leverage as the gold price or silver price goes higher, that, you know, the cash flow is going to find its way to the bottom line. And that'll also allow, you know, for dividends to be paid and the shareholders to benefit. We're starting to see that this time around. Last time around in the last cycle in 2000, you know, there was so much equity issuance that the shareholders were being debased faster than the central banks were debasing the currency. And so, you're not seeing this at so far. You know, there's been discipline on capital allocation. And so as that confidence comes into the marketplace, you know, we'll start to see even further capital come in. You know, the fact that, you know, and there's been a lot made of Warren Buffett making a purchase of through Berkshire Hathaway of the Barrick position of about $500 million selling bank stocks. I think what it shows is that institutional money is starting to get more comfortable again. You know, even the Ohio Police and Fire Pension, which is about a $16 billion pension fund, allocated 5% towards gold assets here over the last couple of weeks, which, you know, the significance of that is that Wilshire Associates is the consultant on it and on the account, and they advise over $1 trillion in assets. So you could see a very significant shift of capital moving into the sector as, you know, if confidence is maintained and there is fear of inflation and there's other catalysts to drive capital, especially if the general equity market were to roll over and it looks to be the only place where you know, there's gains in terms of earnings per share growth. And there is significant earnings per share and cash flow growth that's going on, Jim.
Well, let's talk about, you know, you're saying that institutional money, whether you're seeing a Berkshire Hathaway or the, you know, the Fireman's Fund coming into this market, this is a very small market. I mean, if you take up all the major gold stocks, add them all together, the market cap doesn't even come close to, let's say, one stock like Microsoft.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, it is Niagara Falls trying to get through the garden hose. So, yeah, that becomes an issue. So you, in order to expand and make room for everybody, you have to take the market caps up. And so, you know, what's the justification for that? And, you know, one of the justifications for that is revaluing the reserves in the ground. And if you get to a point where the market loses confidence in COMEX contracts and paper gold contracts in terms of delivery and counterparty risk, you know, so where do you turn? You turn to, you know, having confidence in the reserves in the ground of the miners. And, you know, for a lot of these mining companies, they haven't seen a increase in the valuation of their reserves in the ground for years, especially on the junior end. I can remember when, in the early 80s and 90s, you know, if companies were being bought out, they'd be bought out on the junior end for $100 an ounce. Well, you know, still, that's a number that hasn't changed a whole lot. even though the gold price has gone from $350 to $1,900, $2,000. So there is room there to expand that out. And it's about, the other way of looking at it is, if you can look at the gold XAU ratio, we went through a period where, there was a lot of confidence. When the confidence was lost in 2008, for years that gold XAU ratio was right around 5 to 6 at the top end. And, we're, been in the 13 range. So we have room to go back to that 5 to 6 range.
Two questions. You mentioned earlier that, if the market or institutions lose confidence in the paper gold market, a lot of trading in gold, especially by hedge funds and institutions, is in the futures market. And there isn't enough gold in the COMEX for people to take delivery. In other words, if all the contracts that were long gold decided they wanted to take delivery, there's a little clause in the futures contract where they could just settle in cash. What are the possibilities at some point? Who knows? It's a crisis. It's something. The dollar crashes or whatever it is, and people want their gold and they can't get it. What's that going to do?
Well, that's going to be the end of confidence in the COMEX. That's the end of the exchange. And so there is hypothecation, rehypothecation. How many claims are on every ounce of gold? I mean, one of the things that, when we look at GLD, for example, and, when the money's coming in and they're having to buy 100 tons or some days, 10 tons, and it's, where do they get that gold? Well, they'll borrow it from the Bank of England. And, so there's multiple claims on the same ounces of gold that trade on a daily basis. And so if the market comes unwound and everybody wants to get delivery, well, you are absolutely going to have to settle on a monetary basis and not on physical, because there isn't enough physical to go around, certainly.
A final question, Greg. What are these gold miners? We've seen the big guys buy other big guys, buying Goldcorp, Randgold, all these companies to replace their reserves are buying other companies. So the big mining companies are doing their mining on Wall Street. What does this imply for future production of gold, and what does this mean for the junior mining market?
Well, the juniors, they've, after years of being starved for capital, what we've seen over the last few months is a real pickup in the capital raising, and there's been appetite there for the juniors, where a number of deals have been upsized. So there is certainly strong demand right now for quality projects, and even projects where there's been a lot of past work done where they've proven up low-grade deposits. And so investors are trying to get their hands on those ounces and the time that it takes place to prove up those ounces. I mean, that's one of the things that gets too much, in my opinion, is time. Time is, the time it takes to drill out a project and permit it is not appreciated enough. And that's one of the things I like to look for is, when a project has had a lot of time spent and dollars put in the ground and it's trading at a discount, there's an opportunity there. And, for the majors, they will, what I'd like to see them do is to make acquisitions earlier in the cycle to where, they don't wait for a project to be totally de-risked, where they actually have confidence in their ability to look at a project and say, okay, this is going to be a mine. We can take it all the way through. We'll take it up the value curve instead of letting the junior take it up the value curve. I think that will create more value for the intermediate and the senior producers. So I think there's going to be some really spectacular, and there already have been some big gains on the junior end, but I think there'll continue to be, in terms of how I construct the portfolio, I mean, I look for those special situations to where, you see an inflection point, there's going to be growth in shareholder value on a per share basis. And discovery through the drill bit is one of the best ways for mining companies, both junior and seniors, to create shareholder value.
So given where we are now, and we're consolidating here with gold, silver, you know, if you look at the chart of gold, silver, and, you know, things like the GDX, they all look the same. What would you be doing as an investor? I think one thing you and I would agree, if you're going to buy bullion, whether it's gold or silver, buy the physical bullion rather than the paper bullion, because the paper bullion, you may not be able to get it.
Right. I totally agree with you. You know, I think that, you know, people always ask me all the time, when, you know, do you buy the stocks or any gold shares or do you buy the bullion? And I said, you know, I think you buy both. And, you know, obviously the shares are going to have some more earnings leverage, and they're going to be more susceptible to you know, the movement of the equity markets in general. But, you know, I would say that the seniors are going to do well. I just think there's going to be a flood of money coming in. I actually think all the sectors from, you know, the senior producers all the way down to the exploration and development companies, I think that the where a lot of people like the royalty companies, I still look at those as being more defensive and, you know, almost bear market type of allocations. So, you know, I would probably be allocating less towards royalty companies here than I would be towards companies with the operating leverage.
Well, listen, Greg, as we close, if people like to find out about the OCM Gold Fund that you run, how could they do so?
Well, we are on, you know, all the major platforms, you know, the Fidelities and Schwabs and all those. They can call their financial advisors. They can go to OCMGoldFund.com. And the other way is just give us a call at 925-455-0802.
All right. Well, listen, Greg, as always, thanks for coming on the program. Stay safe and come back again.
All right. Thanks, Jim. Appreciate it.
Are you getting closer to retirement? Do you worry about what retirement will look like? Financial Sense Wealth Management can help put your mind at ease. Our advisors can help customize an individual retirement plan that fits your needs and helps you get on the right track to achieving your retirement goals. We'll show you how to get the most out of your Social Security benefits, make the right decisions on Medicare, reduce taxes, and increase your return on investments so you can relax and enjoy your retirement years. Don't leave your retirement up to chance. Contact Financial Sense Wealth Management today at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
The government has poured trillions and trillions of dollars. The government's fiscal year ends at the end of this month. And the budget deficit is going to be a record. It's estimated it's going to be $3.3 trillion. We're at $27 trillion in national debt. And we'll be, at this rate, we'll be at $30 trillion by next year. So the government has spent a lot of money. Now, this is a political election year. And the Republicans want to extend certain benefits. They want to spend close to $1 trillion. Democrats want to spend close to $3 trillion, which would include almost $1 trillion to bail out states like New York, California, Illinois, which have mismanaged their economy. So the two parties are at impasse. But what I want to talk about here is what happens if nothing is done going forward, what this could mean for economic activity. And you're seeing this reflected in the charts in certain sectors. Our technician this week, Dave Nikoski, talked about the breakdown in regional banks on this Friday. The regional bank index, KRE, has just broken below its 200-day moving average. You've got the XLF, which is the financial sector ETF, bordering on breaking through its 200-day moving average. You've got the REIT index, which is broken below its 200-day moving average. And what I want to do is bring this all together and kind of make some sense out of what I'm seeing as nonsensical economic policies.
Yeah, Jim, what I find really interesting is the fact that most of the narrative is concerned with COVID or a vaccine that's being developed and rolled out in order to inoculate the U.S. population and prevent its spread. That's where most of the focus is. And as we've discussed on FS Insider with Operation Warp Speed, the earliest that we're supposed to see some type of vaccine rolled out, according to the CDC, is to prepare for late October, early November. However, there's a whole host of ripple effects, unintended consequences, some of which are obvious and some of which are not obvious, which means as money managers, we need to be not just focused on the COVID data or on the vaccine release, but also on certain segments of the market that are being affected and which may be flagging further trouble ahead. When we look at the financial sector and the regional banking sector and other economically sensitive parts of the market.
Yeah, I mean, let's take a look at and follow this logically, and this will explain what you're seeing in the charts that Dave Nikoski talked about. So let's assume you're a business. You're a retail business. You could be a restaurant. You could be a gym. You could be a jeweler. You could be a clothing store. Whatever it is, you have a business. You have sales, and you are leasing space from somebody that owns a shopping center. It could be a mortgage REIT. It could be a real estate commercial REIT that owns the shopping center or the strip mall. So the government comes in and says, you can't operate. You're non-essential. You can't do business. You could be a hair salon, a nail salon, whatever it is. So the government shuts you down. What does that mean? Unless you have gotten money from the government, PPP, which allows you to spend money to keep your employees furloughed but still on the payroll and to meet your rent payments. That's what PPP was for. It was used for two things, rent and employees mainly. So that is running out, and that's what they're negotiating on both sides. And so far, a lot of that hasn't happened. Now, the president is using executive orders to extend unemployment benefits. But let's go back to the business. The business is still shut down because the governor, like in California, or it could be New York, it could be Illinois, it could be Michigan, whoever it is, whatever state it is, you can't operate. So what does that mean? You're not open for business, so you're not getting sales. Sales aren't coming in. Unless you've, like some restaurants have done takeout, but it's only a fraction of what your business is. But for a lot of these businesses, they've been put out. If you're a gym, you're not open. If you're a hair salon, you're not open. If you're a nail salon, you're not open. If you're a jewelry store, you're not open. You're considered non-essential. So you're not getting sales. So what does that mean? It means you're leasing that space from the landlord. So if you don't have any money coming in, you cannot make your lease payments. So let's take that a step further. Now the landlord, which probably has a mortgage on the shopping mall or strip center, now the landlord is not getting lease payments from his tenants because his tenants' business have been shut down. So there's forbearance. So they are not making payments to the landlord. Now let's take this a step further. If the landlord is not getting lease payments from his tenants or her tenants or whatever the case is, that means the landlord is not making payments to the bank. So there's a ripple effect here. Sales aren't happening, which means the business isn't earning any profits. It's probably laying off workers, which means those workers aren't getting wages, which means they're not paying taxes and they're probably on unemployment. The landlord or the business cannot make lease payments to the landlord. The landlord isn't getting lease payments and can't make payments to the banks. So if you have a chart program and you look at XLF, which is the financial sector, which is breaking down below its 200-day average, if you look at KRE, which is the regional banks, which Dave Nikoski talked about, that has broken through its 50-day and its 200-day average. If you look at the XLRE, which is the real estate REIT index, it is breaking down below its 200-day. What is happening is there's a ripple effect that goes all the way through the system when you shut down a business. Now, let's take this over to the government side. When a business is operating, it's making profits. Let's think pre-COVID. So if a business is making profits, what does that mean? You're paying taxes to the federal government. You're paying taxes to the state government. What happens if your business is shut down? There goes the corporate profits. You are no longer profitable because you're shut down. So that means you're not paying corporate taxes. Then probably if you've laid off your employees, they aren't paying income taxes to the state or the federal government. And if they're unemployed and laid off, they are now collecting unemployment benefits. So at the state level, the state has just lost tax revenues. At the same time, it's having to dish out money for unemployment claims. And therefore, the budget deficits are going through the roof for most of these states. So there's all of this is linked both at the government level and at the economic level. So unless you are going to reopen the economy and allow businesses to reopen, and that doesn't mean if you're a restaurant, you can only have tables outside, or if you're a restaurant, you can only have 25% capacity because you're going to lose money. You can't make money at 25% capacity. And that's why Monday there's going to be a protest in New York against de Blasio, because he's saying you can't open up to the end of September and only partially. You can't stay in business. 65% of the restaurants in New York are going to go out of business. Now, let's translate that, what's happening in New York, what's also happening to New York on the fiscal budget side. The mayor is saying that they are so deep in the hole, unless they get bailout money, they may have to let go of 22,000 workers. Well, if you shut a business down and you're not getting tax revenues, well, what do you think is going to happen to your own budget? So all of this stuff is interlinked, and this is why people like Jim Bianco, this is why Dave Nikoski is talking about this on the charts, it's why Ryan Sweet is saying if we don't open up or at least extend PPP further, we could get back into a double-dip recession. So as good as these third quarter numbers look, it may be totally different in the fourth quarter. I mean, what if, just, you know, hopefully this doesn't happen, but flu season starts at the end of this month. So what if we get an uptick in cases? And these governors saying, you know what, we're not opening schools. Now let's take this a little further. So a lot of these mayors and governors are saying, you can't open up the schools. Well, what does this mean on the job market? A lot of couples today are two wage earner couples. So mom goes to work, the kids go to school. Well, what happens if the kids don't go to school and they stay at home? Who's going to watch them? That means mom may have to stay at home. So, Chris, there is a ripple effect all through this economy, which we're seeing reflected in key areas right now, which is why Dave's concerned about what we're seeing in regional banks, the financial index, and then the REIT index. It's all related. And then if you flip it over onto the government side, it's why New York is talking about they may have to lay off 22,000 workers. Well, if you're not getting tax revenues and you're not getting bailed out, that's why the economists are saying if we don't extend PPP further, if you're going to keep everything shut down, then you've got to have an extension of PPP to businesses to keep them afloat and keep the workers from going on unemployment, or otherwise you've got to open up. I mean, something has got to give here. You either got to come out with a massive stimulus for as long as you're going to keep this shut down, or you've got to start opening up. I mean, folks, this is just pure math at this point. I mean, just follow my example logically. Cut out sales. How can that business operate? It can't. How can a business keep people on payroll when they don't have their doors open. And if they can't keep people, if they can't operate as a business, how are they going to make the lease payments to the office space or the business space or retail space that they operate? And then if they can't make their lease payments, how's the landlord going to make those payments to the bank? And remember, a lot of times, a lot of these mortgages are securitized. So this also means this could be bad news for investors. So this is one reason why I believe you saw the Fed intervene in the corporate bond market, because 50% of corporate bonds are triple B. And if they get downgraded to double B, that would be a massive dumping by all these investment funds. And you would have a credit crisis, which we were starting to see develop in February and March until the Fed intervened in the corporate bond market. They're intervening in the corporate bond market. They're intervening in the municipal bond market, because these municipalities, if they're not taking in tax revenues, either on a revenue bond or a general obligation bond, they could be in trouble. So all of this is interlinked. You cannot shut down an economy and expect to grow your way to prosperity. It just doesn't work. And so that's why, Chris, I think you're seeing a lot of this reflected. And to make matters worse, some of these same governments that are shutting down their economy are talking about massive increases, and that includes our own state of California. There's two bills in California that have passed the assembly. One would impose a 0.4% wealth tax on everything you own. If you have a private business, you would pay a wealth tax on it. If you have a personal portfolio, if you have an IRA or pension plan. Then also, they're talking about raising the income tax rates, which are the highest in the country, at 13.3 to 16.8. But it doesn't stop there. On the ballot in November, they want to repeal the caps on raising property taxes on commercial property. So imagine if you're a mall owner, like a REIT, if you are, let's say, a real estate investor, you own a strip center, or you own a commercial office building, and your tenants are shut down, they're not making their lease payments, and then on top of that, California wants to raise your property taxes. Chris, this is economic suicide. I mean, it's if you think there's an exodus in California that's taking place now, I mean, I have friends that live in Idaho, I have friends that live in Nevada, I have friends in Arizona, and I've been following all three of those real estate markets, and, you know, Toll Brothers has 16 projects in Reno. They can't build homes fast enough. There's projects in Henderson, in Las Vegas, all being sold out. Same thing's going on in Phoenix. It's a mass exodus. So what you're seeing in the charts is being reflected by what's going on in the economy. And basically, if we keep down this road, something is going to give. Either the government is going to have to come to terms with both parties and extend a massive, when I say massive, multi-trillion dollar extension of unemployment benefits, PPP loans to businesses, or you're going to have to reopen the economy. It's going to have to be one of those two, because if you don't, we're going right back down into a double dip recession. It's just, folks, at this point, it is simply mathematics.
So, Jim, in some of what we discussed today, and we look at the regional banking index or the financial sector, put all this together for us in terms of what we at Financial Sense Wealth Management are watching and doing when it comes to these potential risks and how we're invested for clients.
Right now, Chris, we're at neutral levels when it comes to the market, and we could quickly either increase that if this gets resolved or decrease that as we did in February, avoiding a downturn. So we're watching our indicators and watching how this issue gets resolved. Will they open up the economy, which will be positive for a recovery, or will they keep it shut down and not provide any stimulus, which would be negative for the economy? And we're going to react depending on the outcome. You know, you just can't sit here. I think Will Rogers once said you could eventually be on the right track, but if you sit there long enough, you'll eventually get run over. And that's what we want to avoid, is getting run over should this flip to the negative. So we're on alert. We're watching this. We're watching our indicators. And depending on whether we reopen the economy or keep it shut down, we'll act accordingly for our clients.
So as always, if you'd like to speak with a member of our team about our outlook or how Financial Sense Wealth Management can assist you or your business, give us a call at 888-486-3939 or email us at grow@financialsense.com.
In the meantime, on behalf of Chris Sheridan and myself, we'd like to thank you for joining us here on the Financial Sense News Hour. Until you and I talk again, stay safe and have a pleasant weekend.
Financial Sense News Hour is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the News Hour each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the Financial Sense staff and do not take into account listener suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Financial Sense News Hour and its parent company shall not be liable for any financial losses that result from investing in any companies mentioned in Financial Sense or arising out of the use of any material on the News Hour. Be advised that you invest at your own risk.